Hello, this is Dr. Gary Sherman, the Heart Guy, and I welcome you to another exciting and informative podcast titled The Heart Guy Presents the Heart of the Matter, bringing you interesting discussions and conversations related to the vast and important subject of heart disease and heart failure and everything related to that in today's ever-changing world. I'm extremely honored to have as my special guest today an inspiring leader in medical technology used in the care of patients with advanced cardiac and pulmonary disease, Mr. Carl Gisnarian. Carl is a senior perfusionist with over 10 years of experience, with a master's degree in cardiovascular science, and holds a master's degree also in business administration. Carl is an author of multiple peer-reviewed publications, most recently one published in June of 2021 concerning airflow within the operating room. Carl is a national and international speaker with recent presentations in Brazil and in Massachusetts for the State Perfusion Society. Carl is experienced in ventricular assist devices, hyperthermic intraperitoneal chemotherapy, blood management, adult cardiac procedures, including transplantation procedures, ECMO procedures, and the use of all perfusion equipment. Carl is a co-founder of EC Mobile, whose mission is to standardize the assessment and communication of critically ill patients from remote centers to advanced care hospitals. Wow, Carl, welcome to the Heart of the Matter. I have a feeling I'm going to learn a lot today.
Hey, thanks, Gary. I appreciate the opportunity here. And, you know, that's what we all want to get out of, everything that we hear. So any questions, everything, you know, this is just a wonderful opportunity. And I'm always happy to kind of come up and center here, because I'll tell you, the past, perfusionists are really not well known. It's not a known type of field. In fact, unless you work in specific healthcare field, those were the normal individuals that would become a perfusionist.
Well, before I will say that before we get going, is one of the real memories that I have as a patient lying there on ECMO, and times that I actually sort of look forward to, believe it or not, being on ECMO, was when the perfusionist would come to adjust that machine for me. And so it did not go unnoticed as far as I was concerned as a patient. I want you to know that.
Well, thank you. I hope they're providing some comedy relief as they were doing their adjustments.
I needed all of that I could get at the time. But even on ECMO, and I we'll get into that a little bit, but I was more awake than you might imagine on the ECMO when I was on it for, I think it was 5 or 6 weeks. So we're alert. We just can't move when we're on that machine. But anyway, before we get into that, I just want to roll back a little. Where did you grow up and when did you know you want to be involved in biological science?
So I was born and raised in Lake Havasu City, Arizona. It was kind of the party central the time that I was growing up for MTV and spring break. And so that was a little bit of a survive or don't survive type childhood in that area because of everything that was going on. But I was able to make it out, and I went to Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff. And I fought my mother tooth and nail that I did not want to do anything medicine. I was very sure of myself that I was going to go into zoology and be a zookeeper. And she's like, you know what? Fine, you go ahead. I'll support you. So I was taking that track, and halfway through the year, one of my classmates that I was good friends at the time was involved in a hit and run in front of me on their bike. And out of shock and fear, I knew I had to do something. I didn't know what. So that kind of started my dabble into the medical field. I went and got my EMT certificate so that I didn't feel helpless and that I could actually help individuals that were hurt in front of me. And then I transitioned my degree from focus of zoology into the pre-med era. And throughout it, I really was interested in the cardiovascular system. And for me, when I had previously mentioned, people that were in the hospital or in specific healthcare fields are the ones that normally transition to perfusionists. That's a very accurate statement, because you don't know about it. I graduated with the idea that I was going to go into nursing school, fast track nursing for a bachelor's, and then kind of work my way up. However, a friend of mine was at Midwestern University in Glendale, and she said, "Hey, I know you really like the cardiovascular system. I know that you really want to do something in medicine. there's this degree called a perfusionist. I'm not sure what it is, but why don't you check it out? So I went down to Midwestern and had no idea what I was getting into. In fact, I tried to do as much research as I can, but all that was really coming up was pacemakers and stopping and starting the heart, and nothing really was coming to mind like what this field is. And I go down there and I remember the interview. They're like, all right, so what do you know about perfusionists? I was like, oh, you guys do something with the heart and it stops it and starts it. It's kind of like a pacemaker. And at the time, they kind of chuckled, and I didn't realize why, because that's so far off from what we do. And then I started my career, and I haven't looked back.
Wow. Yeah. So now that we've been dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic, most people have actually heard the term ECMO in regard to life-saving treatment of very sick patients in our hospitals. So let's start off. Please explain what ECMO exactly is.
So ECMO, in the shortest terms, is the function of a mechanical device to take over either the heart and or the lungs. And so it provides the movement of blood through the body and oxygenation. For COVID-19, everyone knows that the lungs are actually the main issue here. And I should take a step back here. We really weren't using ECMO. We had a lot of negative results from ECMO in adults. It was first started in 1970s in California, and it helped a child. However, when we tried to make the transition into the adult population, it was unsuccessful. And then in 2009 to 2011, we had that avian flu, right? H1N1 that came in, and everyone suddenly, you had to make sure you're vaccinated. And we returned back to what was then called VenoVeno and is now still called VenoVeno ECMO. And what we're doing there is we're providing oxygen to the right side of your heart so that it could pump blood to the rest of the body that's oxygenated and not count on the lungs. And what we're finding is that there's a success. These patients that were on that had difficulty in breathing, that ventilator support was no longer managing, when you put them on VenoVeno, they had a greater chance of surviving and coming over through it. So now we get into COVID, and this is like another level of lung problems, because COVID, unlike the flu, the average days when I was talking to a lot of surgeons and cardiac surgeons that were dealing with these patients, the average length of stay was 42 days. Whereas with the flu, it was less. It was about 14 to 21. So COVID was taking longer for these patients now to come out. And they, some did and some didn't. And it's unfortunate. But we're still managing and understanding why this is and what is the best ECMO type procedure for these individuals. And so in summary, right now, what we have for this is, we provide oxygen to the right side of the heart. And if we think of the heart as being in two areas, the right and left, the right normally takes deoxygenated blood from the body, and then it passes it through the lungs. And then the lungs pass it to the left side, which then passes it to the rest of the body so that you can move and talk and walk and feel that you're getting the energy that you need for daily activities. Except when your lungs aren't working, what the right passes over goes directly to the left as if it hadn't even seen the lung. And so now your body's not getting those nutrients. And so ECMO is providing that oxygen so that it can go from right to left, yeah, and the lungs can take a break.
Yeah. While most people who understand anything about heart failure think of it as left-sided for the most part, and it probably is on a percentage basis. Many times the heart failure is right-sided heart failure, where the lungs are not functioning or the pathway to the lungs is not functioning there.
So in terms of the right versus left heart failure, you will see right heart failure if people have a pulmonary embolism. So there's resistance that the right side isn't used to, because the physiology makeup does not have the muscle or the strength that's compared to the left, right? Because the left has to push blood to the entire body, where the right just needs to push blood through some lungs. And so the resistance is always lower. And when there's a change in that resistance, the right will take a hit. And that's what COVID's also causing, is this change in resistance. So the right is taking a little bit of a hit and needs a little bit of a rest. If we can catch it in time, Normally what we can do is we can help reduce that resistance and still provide the oxygen that's required for the heart to still function normally. And so they don't go into heart failure. They just have lung failure. So then really you only need to provide support for the lungs, hence veno-veno.
Yeah. Wow. So interesting. And thank you for explaining that so clearly, because it's not easy for most people to understand. I think most people don't understand much about the way their heart works to begin with, but that made it a lot clearer. And to remind everybody, I think our heart beats upwards of 100,000 times a day. So that heart-lung system is really important to our life on a minute-by-minute basis.
Yeah, so it's 80 to 120 beats a minute.
Yeah, exactly. Normal, yeah. So why is the use of ECMO standardized?
So we have ELSO, which is the one ECMO type group that's out there that a lot of hospitals rely on to help identify what type of patients can go on, how to really standardize the ECMO program within the hospital, and what would be kind of what marks the best patient to put on it. Because when we first were doing this, we really couldn't identify the best client. And what I mean by that, and it sounds kind of, you know, bad in terms of, though, if you're going to put someone on ECMO and give the family hope and give them this opportunity that their loved one is going to survive, you want to make sure that this therapy is actually going to provide that. And it's only through continued research and understanding the data points that we've been able to almost narrow down who is more likely to require ECMO and who is more likely to successfully be explanted and then come to a quality of life after ECMO that they were at before, right? Because it's not just about saving their life. It's about ensuring you can return to a normal type process. You know, are you made whole afterwards? And that can be, normally that's a legal term of when people look at trying to, you know, sue or provide a lawsuit, is that you're trying to make that person whole after what happened to them. And we're trying to do that with ECMO. But if we go through the whole run and you come off and then you can't leave the hospital and you're stuck in hospice for the rest of your life, to you, would that mean that's the best quality of life? Is that what you wanted for the rest of your living years? And I think we're still battling that, honestly. I think we're still trying to come to an agreement just as human beings of accepting what fate has been and where they may be going. We have tried. But is this the life this individual would have wanted? And we keep pushing it off and before answering, because we don't really want to face that answer. Does that make sense?
Yeah. No, it's something that I've discussed with Dr. Joyce, as a matter of fact, my cardiologist, cardiothoracic surgeon, to be probably in a very short time, as a matter of fact. But we've discussed that in regard to the definition of death and when doctors determine when somebody has died and is it worth keeping them alive for an extended period of time on life support if their quality of life is not going to be what that person might have wanted.
Yes. And, yeah. You know, you bring up two points there. One, you know, keeping them alive. And then two, is that the quality of life they would have wanted, that discussion with the family. So the first one, when you're on ECMO, whether it's venous-venous or venous-arterial, where we're providing oxygenation and flow, so we're taking over for the heart and the lungs. We can make individuals look like textbook when it comes to pressures, mm-hmm. when it comes to organ function. We can make all of the parameters look as if they're healthy. Mm-hmm. But if you were to stop ECMO, the body would then just be done and it would shut off. Mm-hmm. And over the years of my experience, I've seen multiple times where we've had these individuals on, and it's hard for the physicians to convince the family that they're not going to make it.
Right.
They look great. They look like they're alive. They look like they're going to be okay.
Right.
You know, and then having that discussion and trying to educate them.
Right. Yeah. Wow. And how complicated that's and difficult that is for the doctors. What a challenging time that is when people are, you know, besides themselves as far as wanting their loved ones to be kept alive. So how long can patients be safely kept on ECMO?
Oh, I used to believe I knew that answer. But with COVID, I'm looking at stories where they survived a 60-day, 70-day, 90-day run on ECMO. And what the most complications with ECMO are bleeding. and it's bleeding because you have an artificial situation set up. And what I mean by that is the machine that's taking care of you, that's keeping that individual alive, is not a human system. It's all foreign material. So your body is continually feeling like it's under attack because it's being, your blood's being removed and then it's being put back, and it's going through rates per minute in the thousands, rotations per minute in the thousands, because of that's what it takes to build up the kinetic energy to move it, to pull it in from the body and then to push it forward. You have to have these revolutions or these rotations in the centrifugal pump. And then it's got to go through an oxygenator, which is a fiber or polymethylene. And it's a completely foreign surface area, and it's a large surface area. And the body's now being exposed to air concentrations that aren't normal. And then it's being pushed back in. So you have bleeding because everything's activated. And you're also on an anticoagulant. Normally, when we talk about anticoagulant, we're talking about like a blood thinner. And the most used is heparin. Sometimes used is bivalirudin. And that's a direct thrombin inhibitor, where heparin helps reduce coagulation through binding with antithrombin 3. That's a little bit more into it. But, these blood thinners then are providing the ability for the blood to move through this foreign surface and not attack it, not clot. However, right, because of the surface area of the oxygenator, clot does form over time.
Right.
And mainly it's because the flow isn't laminar. It gets disrupted. And so there's areas where there's stagnation. And so stagnation will cause clot because the blood has time to sit there and activate and congeal and grab a hold of the surface in that oxygenator. Whereas when we're looking at the tubing, there's nothing for the blood really to hold on to. There's laminar flow. So everything that's going through the tubing is moving as one. So nothing normally forms in those areas.
Right.
But
I was going to say the biggest concern I know with the ventricular assist devices, I have HeartMate 3, but I know going from HeartMate 2 evolving to HeartMate 3, the biggest problem that was faced was the blood clotting on that pump, on that little motor that was that's attached. And they have greatly improved that to the point where there's very few incidents of stroke or anything related to clotting with HeartMate 3. I was born lucky, you know, because I was able to get HeartMate 3 as opposed to HeartMate 2, because, you know, that was one of the major problems there. So it's very familiar to me.
Yeah. And, you know, that's great. When I saw the HeartMate 3 results come out, I was very surprised, because I know that before that was a HeartWare and it was smaller as well. It's in the same type of family as the HeartMate 3, and there were still strokes with it. The difference that we're seeing with the HeartMate 3 versus the HeartMate 2 is one, the HeartMate 3 is a centrifugal pump that's floating. So it floats within the blood itself and it pulses.
Mm-hmm.
So it provides a speed up and speed down, continuous movement. So there's really little to stagnation. There's little areas where the blood can wait and clot, and it's moved throughout the system in a very dynamic type of way. So the HeartMate 2, because it's an impeller like a boat, it, you know, just spins, and there's areas where it could clot and it could slow down and it could form just because of extra stress or extra exercise or just a little change in resistance or change in volume.
Right.
The dynamic of the HeartMate 3 is a lot better for patients such as yourself when you're looking at your quality of life and walking. So kudos for also paying attention to the doctor and making sure to, you know, stay on your anticoagulants.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, those are measured every day. And to that, my nurse practitioner, I give her a lot of credit, because she'll call me up sometimes and say, what did you eat for dinner last night? Because if you eat a lot of greens, you know, you create that vitamin K in your system and you got to up the blood thinner a little bit. So it's something that they are definitely looking at day to day with me. So to their credit, once you're aware of that. So patient has a serious cardiac or pulmonary event. They're placed on ECMO. What's the next step? I know for me, obviously, it was either transplantation or the VAD. Is that pretty much it? Does the patient have any chance of leaving the hospital otherwise?
So, you know, it's hard to say. It's how bad is the event? What is it that caused it? ECMO in the past was used as a last-ditch effort. Now it's being used as a decision. So they would define an individual as, you know, they're having respiratory problems. So let's put them on and let's try to identify what's causing the problem, right? And then can we fix the problem? And so that's what ECMO is now starting to be used for. And so the question you're asking here is, where do we go when we put them on? And you with every patient, you really don't know. So UNOS changed the way their numbers are. If you're on ECMO, you're going to get placed first normally now for a heart,
right?
Whereas if you're on a device such as yourself, you're later because they've been durable, because they've shown that they provide a very good quality of life. Endangerment of needing a new heart is less than someone who's on ECMO. So if it's a heart failure issue and they put them on, the question is, are they a candidate for transplant?
Right.
And so they have to run through the full gamut. And every transplant program has so many different services that are involved because it's so important to make sure they are the right candidate, that they get the right support, and that it's the right decision.
Yeah, it's extremely complicated. I've learned that personally, of course, and I think a lot of us are learning that now that we're becoming more aware of these situations. I think people, our listeners, are a little more aware of this process, which is so complicated, and it's objective in one sense and subjective in another, which, you know, also lends to the complexity of it.
Yeah, and there's a lot still that we're having more subjective thought with than objective, and that's with ECMO as well. I would like to have more facts. I would like to have more theories. However, we just still need more research. Most of the care and the continued approaches are hypothetical. They're based on feelings and personal experience rationale. So that's something that I think also can glean forward and move towards in the future. You know, of course, they're an international type organization. And as an organization, you really don't want to make too many strong recommendations just so you're not held liable, you know. But I think when we're looking at transplants and we're kind of going back, because that was a tangent, there's a lot that we still can learn from and that we can still look at and try to make this an objective versus like subjective type thinking.
Yeah. I mean, I studied a lot about the history of the therapies and the development of the possible cures for heart failure. And it's so interesting, but through it all, there were risks all along the way. And there still are risks in all of these procedures. As a medical practitioner, I know in my practice, there were always, you know, some level of risk to every procedure that we do in medicine. But, you know, the idea is that we do these procedures in the hope that we learn as we go along and in the big picture be able to save more people, despite the fact that sometimes patients are lost, you know, in trying to save them, it doesn't work out. I think it's just part of the medical process, really.
Yes, and that's unfortunate that even still in 2000, that's how the process still is.
Yeah, I know, and I understand that. So what's on the horizon in the future with regard to this type of life-saving equipment? Are things changing? Or, you know, are you seeing new types of equipment now?
Oh, yeah. So the horizon is grand because cardiac surgery, honestly, has been around since the 1950s. We've had the first successful bypass was in 1953 or 54 with the Gibbon heart-lung machine. And since then, it's the explosion in cardiac surgery has just been astronomical. The slope is great. You know, we always try to find those new fields and what's the best area. I think for cardiopulmonary bypass and open heart surgery, we have a mortality of 3-4%, and it's hard right now to really work on trying to bring that down, but we are giving it our all. We're looking at blood management. We're limiting the amount of prime, which is fluid we use to remove air in the circuit so that when we go on pump, the body has a stabilization type factor so it doesn't feel like it's taking a loss. We have better reservoirs, better oxygenators, better cardioplegia delivery to stop the heart and arrest it so that the surgeon can work on it. We have better ways of managing the blood loss. And then when we look at ECMO, we have what was then just cardiopulmonary bypass circuits that were made to hopefully withstand, you know, days, weeks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now we have circuits that are going to be eligible and FDA approved for, I think, 7 days. And we have new oxygenators, new types of cannulas that are used to access and return the blood. We have new compact devices that have a pump, oxygenator, all in one for ECMO. And there's just so much that is kind of improving. Even our heater coolers are becoming, so these are devices that keep you warm, or if you have heart failure and they might suspect some brain injury, they might try to cool you for a little bit, 24 hours, and then warm you back up to help reduce that injury from expanding. We have new types of heater coolers that are coming out. And for transplants, you know, you used to be a heart in a box or a heart in a cooler that's on ice. Right. We have devices now that maintain 3 to 4 degrees centigrade for the entire heart. So it's not just sitting on one side of the ice. We have devices that provide warm blood for the heart so that it can beat.
Yeah.
And this is allowing for organs to actually come from longer distances. Because right now, we're limited. There's a four-hour window where when you transplant someone, you want to get that heart from the donor to the recipient within 4 hours and blood back in it. Because that's shown to cause the least amount of damage. Well, these devices, I think what we're going to see over time is the ability to push that 4 hours to 6 to 8, maybe even to 12 or 14. So that now your organ, you know, you could be in New York, but your organ's going to come from Hawaii. And that opens up a lot more availability.
Yeah. And to that, I just want to mention, of course, that time is a really important factor with regard to, especially to keeping the heart functional when it's being passed from the donor to the recipient. The time is so key. I had the, you know, obviously the honor of speaking to Dr. Joyce about DCD heart transplantation and his work with that group in London, in Cambridge. And so it's real. It's here already. And it's just a question of making that a central part of the way heart transplantation is done. I know that with some other organs, they're already doing quite a bit of DCD heart organ transplantation, I should say. But the heart being so sensitive to the oxygen level, it's really very important. It will make so many more organs available for people, which is a big, you know, obviously our biggest challenge now.
Yeah. And so, you know, I'm not sure how much you went into the DCD and what that means. You know, it came about because there's a lot of people that were die of cardiac death, but still seem to have really good organ function.
Right.
And I would say that this, most of this really came from Europe and Canada. They pioneered really the thought of, just because the heart dies doesn't mean the rest of the organs are bad. And so I've gone on some DCDs where we've gotten the organ and it's turned out great. The individual walks out. And then other ones where we didn't take it because it wasn't within a certain time frame. So the heart has a time frame to where it needs to stop. And then the procurers need to get in as quick as possible to minimize damage to the rest of the organ. But if the heart is slow to end, what happens is the blood backs up, there's a little flow, and then organ damage sets in over a period of time.
Right, right.
So DCDs are still, they're there, and these machines that are available now have the ability to take the organs, provide the necessary nutrients and care to see if they come back.
Yeah.
And that's what's amazing.
It is amazing. And I do want to just backpedal a little bit and mention companies like Paragonics that have developed these machines that keep the heart at optimal temperatures in the transit of the organs. There's a movie called The God Committee that's on Netflix right now, and you can actually see that machine at work. They kind of used it as a prop in the movie, but, you know, quite realistically. But I know that those companies are extraordinary, Paragonics, and there are a couple of others that are doing that kind of work so that they can extend the life of the heart and keep it optimal while it's being transported.
Yeah, so the ones that I know, Paragonics, XVIVO, and Transmedics are all in this procurement type field, and they each have their own type of way of providing and securing the organ. And I'll tell you this, though, it seems rationally to be better than just placing an organ over ice or in fluid and letting it sit in fluid over ice.
Yeah. Like we're carrying a six pack of beer to the beach, you know?
Exactly. And you don't want to show that in a movie. know, that's for sure. Oh, yeah, we have the heart in the igloo cooler here, you know.
Although that's been the way of the world for the last 50 years, I suppose.
It has been, because they've been consistent, because it's been proven, because healthcare is a hard field to change over time. Mm-hmm. And to move into areas because it works.
Right.
You know, we have these new things out here, and it's great to get excited and it's great to try it out. We just need to validate it, and we take our time, because if we didn't, and then we came to you and said, hey, there's this new thing. It's great. It's awesome. It's fantastic. And your organ didn't work, and you're left on the operating table with a dead heart, you know, because we didn't go through the necessary steps. That's not something anyone wants to go out and tell a family to. No one wants to be in that situation.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. In my career, I've had two cases where the patients were not coming off the table, and it was an emergency type case. These aren't transplants. These are emergencies where they had either an aortic dissection or they had a serious cardiac arrest event, and we tried our best. Just nothing was getting better. The organs were shutting down. The stitching and the tissues themselves were so friable that they were just breaking apart. And besides going into an ECMO room and turning the machine off with the family there, I think you can prepare for that type of intervention. Whereas when you are called in an emergency to try to help someone for a last shot, and it doesn't go through, it takes a toll on the individuals. And
yeah,
you know, those are still with me, burned in my brain.
Yeah.
Because it's a trauma event.
Yeah. You know what? And thank you for that, because mm-hmm. your passion for doing what you do, we as patients certainly could not ask for more than that. And so I so appreciate the way you go about what you do, the way you explain it, and the way you feel about your work. And, you know, the people that are involved like you and the surgeons too, they're human beings. And when they lose patients, I think it takes a toll. Like you said, it's very tough on everybody involved. But, you know, we have to remember that the things that you are being done so that you can save as many people as possible. And that's really the most important part of this, but I do thank you for the kind of work that you do. So along those lines, tell me about your company, EC Mobile, just to change course here, and what problems you solve now with EC Mobile.
You know, it kind of actually falls right in line here, and thank you for bringing this up. Our company is looking to actually help with the assessment and communication of the critically ill patients. And what we're finding is patients that may require that are in heart failure or are in lung failure, respiratory failure, they are kind of sitting at remote hospitals, remote centers, where the physicians believe they're doing what they can, and they are. They're trying their best to help these individuals out, and they're just stuck, and they don't know who else to call. And with the way the healthcare field is really built, we've created these silos, and it's also known as like a hub and spoke model, where if you don't have a hub or a major medical center that's attached to you as a remote center, you are on your own to kind of make the connections and the network that's needed to manage patients that might, you know, just be out of your league in terms of what you can provide in care.
Right.
And so EC Mobile, what we want to do is we want to just give all physicians this network communication that's simple, that's broad, and provides a scope of saying, hey, the individual that you have at your center may be a great fit for ECMO. And you don't know me, but based on what you sent out to us here in our field, I think we should chat. And it gives that hand for these physicians that don't know who to call.
Right.
And, you know, we're actually going to be presenting the standards of communication or lack thereof that we have in terms of communication between hospitals that aren't related at the Mass State Perfusion Society. And mm-hmm. one of the other problems is you may know a center, except here with COVID, all the beds are filling up, all the machines are being taken over. Mm. So if that center doesn't have the space for your patient now, who do you call? And most individuals don't have a second person, don't have a second hospital.
Mm-hmm.
They have the one. And if it's not there, then what do you do? And there's articles out there that we, you know, there's one that I show, and there's other stories I've read of people going onto social media and asking for help.
Right.
Help us find these other ECMO centers. And that's, I think that's the greatest problem that EC Mobile is trying to solve right now.
Wow.
Is we want to be that bridge, that link between everyone so that they can get where they're going.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a terrible feeling. I mean, I was a dental practitioner, and there were times where the cases were so complex that it got to the point where it was like, boy, what are the answers here now? And I was fortunate to have some people to reach out in the toughest of circumstances that I could count on to help me solve those problems. But it's a hard feeling, you know, it's a tough feeling to think about it and not really know where to go next. So to have those answers is really critical. It's really important.
It is. And, you know, you've gone through medical school, you've created the network, you have the individuals you can rely on, you know, that you can connect with. Let's take it back to just those guys who, they just want to work. They didn't go to medical school. They try to avoid the hospital unless mm-hmm. it's something critical. And now they're here and the family's here and they don't have that knowledge. They put a lot of trust into the physicians.
Right.
And it's hard. I just can't imagine what, as a physician, you'd have to go through trying to explain the next steps and knowing that you as yourself are stuck,
yep.
right? You don't have that other reach.
It's a great problem that you try and solve there. Is there any more general advice that you'd want to leave our listeners with, whether they be doctors or patients who may have heart failure or are caring for someone with heart failure, or even doctors treating people that they might suspect have heart failure?
Yeah, my advice, or I would say something that I think we as healthcare professionals have turned away from, but we need to go back to, is we need to start looking at second opinions.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to start looking at advice from outside our circle, because the views and the experiences of others is so valuable that if we're not capturing it, if we're not talking and we're not listening to all that's around us, then we're going to miss critical experiences and critical information that, yeah, it may be a one-off, just a tangent. However, you may have that tangent now.
I got to tell you, Carl, this for me personally has touched on so many levels for me, has hit home as a patient and as a healthcare provider. What you've done and what you continue to do is so important, and I'm so glad to have gotten to know you here. This is truly enlightening. I personally can go on forever talking to you, but maybe we'll do this again a little later on in the process. But I know my listeners will agree this has been so enlightening, and certainly been my honor to have you as a guest here on The Heart of the Matter. So thank you. I hope you'll come again.
Oh, of course, Gary. This has been pleasant. And I always willing to come on and talk and inform or even debate, because it's not about my feelings. It's not about me. It's about you. It's about the people. It's about the physicians and getting a discussion and conversation going. I think we see that that's needed. And we see that at some point we all can connect. How do we help?
Yeah, well, I know what's not debatable is how much your heart is in your work here and what you're doing. So thank you so much again for sharing this time with us. And I look forward to doing this again soon.
Definitely. Thank you so much.
Great. That is our podcast for today. Please join me next time for another intriguing, informative, and entertaining conversation. Please visit our website at www.drhearttoheart.net. for upcoming podcasts, or if you'd like me to host an online presentation for your group or organization. If you'd like to be a guest on The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter, please email me at theheartguyspeaks@gmail.com. Our podcast can be found on Apple iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all you have to do is search The Heart Guy Presents The Heart of the Matter and you'll find it. And this is Dr. Gary Sherman, The Heart Guy, wishing you peace and hope.